His divine grace today, Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada ki hai. Sri Prabhupada ki hai. Vantarachi Mad Bhagavatam ki jai. Nitai Gopremanande Hari Hari Go Samavita Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. All glory to the assembled devotees. All glory to the assembled devotees. All glory to the assembled devotees. All glory to Sri Sri Guru Gaudama. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tonight I was going to speak some about Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is extremely important for us. Sometimes there may be an idea that a new person should only read Bhagavad Gita, but that's not a fact, actually. In fact, our understanding of Bhagavad Gita is guided by our understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam. Our Siddhanta is especially brought out in the Srimad Bhagavatam, so we can penetrate into the mysteries of Bhagavad Gita better if we have some understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's our, in many ways, our foundational literature, even more important than Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavatam, of course, was spoken 5,000 years ago, different times. I'm always, when I read things in the Bhagavatam about things that happened 5,000 years ago, all kinds of miraculous things, things that we're not used to, it's, you can note that it was different time, definitely different times back then, 5,000 years ago. In many ways, of course, people had the same inclinations, but also things were different. People, of course, were much more cultured thousands of years ago, especially when Vedic culture, culture based on the Vedic literature, was very prominent in the world. But people were much more religious and attuned to reality, really. But 5,000 years ago, those were seers. Throughout history, especially in ancient times, there are those who were blessed because of their practice and many lifetimes of practice. They're able to penetrate into the mysteries of reality. So these great seers, they could see that their troubles were coming. Of course, the ages cycle, just like the seasons cycle. So they could see that a new age was coming, the age of quarrel, the age of Kali. And they could see that all bad qualities would be there in people. So naturally, one of the great characteristics of a saintly person is compassion. You can't be a saintly person, a saint, unless you have a soft heart. You have compassion within your heart for the suffering of people. And especially what these seers understand is that people suffer because of ignorance, because they don't know what is reality and what should be done and what should not be done. They're acting against their best interest without knowing it. So they see these things and they think, well, what can we do? How can we help people in the coming age? So especially 5,000 years ago, we hear at the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, so just to summarize a little, it begins with three verses by Srila Vyasadeva, who is the author of the Puranas and the compiler of the Vedas. Vyasadeva, he was one of these great seers, one of the most prominent. And one of the first things he did was that the Vedas were already existing in oral form, in word, and passed down from generation to generation of guru and disciple. And but the Vedas were one big conglomerate, and he decided to break them up into parts to make them more easily understood by people who were not going to be so intelligent in coming times. So he took the one Veda and divided it into four, and he also assigned to his different disciples protection and the teaching of other parts of the Vedic literature, including the Puranas and what are called the Itihasas, which are the history, which is the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. So the Puranas are extremely important. There's a kind of, sometimes there's a, especially in the academic world, sometimes there are people that think, well, the Puranas, they're just all this stories and mythology and so on. The real substance is there in the Vedas, the original Vedas. But this is not true, actually. The Vedas are very difficult to understand. They're written for former times. Of course, they're eternal, but they were extant in human society, prominent in human society in former times. People could understand them. There's a certain context that they have to be understood in. And unless you're acculturated to that, unless you understand that, unless you're part of that world, you won't understand. It's like someone coming into our world today, say from, you know, 500 years ago, dropping into modern Kali Yuga America, and they would be completely disoriented. So people are disoriented when they read the Vedas. You know, the scholars, they try to understand it, they come up with a lot of times really crazy ideas because they just don't know what the context is. So the Puranas are actually meant to help us understand the Vedas. This is described in the Puranas themselves and other Vedic literature. The word Purana is connected to the word Purana, which means to complete. It also means old, so it's also used to refer, it's a word for histories also. But it does mean Purana, which means to complete, which means you won't get a complete understanding of the Vedic literature unless you understand the Puranas. So Vyasadeva, he compiled these 18 Puranas, and he wrote the Mahabharata. And as we hear in the Srimad Bhagavatam, so he wrote the first three verses of this Srimad Bhagavatam, introducing the, actually these introductory verses, as in any sacred literature, they are meant for one of the reasons. They have several purposes, actually. There are technical reasons why things are done in certain ways in writing Vedic literature. But one of them is, as we say, invoking auspiciousness. So you invoke the blessings of the Lord when you're going to write about him, when you're going to prepare some literature in his glorification or to teach others about him. So Vyasadeva, he gives his three introductory verses of the Bhagavatam, and then you can say the narration begins, the story begins. So what do we hear about? We hear about these sages, and they're about to begin a sacrifice. Now one thing about the Srimad Bhagavatam is right away you start encountering things that you say, what? How can that be? So one of the first things you hear in the fourth verse of the Bhagavatam is these sages are about to begin a 1,000-year sacrifice. So you read that and say, whoa. We try to do a 24-hour kirtan. They're going to do a 1,000-year sacrifice. So it's like, well, that's a pretty heavy endeavor, isn't it? Actually, today, even still, this goes on sometimes. I think maybe even in other religions where they have like an eternal flame going. Right? In former times, the Brahmin families especially, they're supposed to have a fire going all the time and never goes out. So in certain temples still in India, there are flames that have been going on for thousands of years. They've been burning. They never let them go out. They're always adding more ghee to them, make sure they don't come out, don't go out. So they set this sankalpa, it's called. It means they make a vow, a determination. We're going to start this sacrifice, and it's going to go on for 1,000 years. So why did they do this? Because it said that they could see the anomalies that were coming. They could see that bad things were coming, and they felt like they had to do something about it. So they were doing these sacrifices, but they weren't completely satisfied. So their verse, it says, we're getting all black from soot and all this smoke, but we're not sure what kind of results we're going to get from this. So we hear right in the beginning, the first verses of the first chapter, that they elect Suta Goswami to be their guru, essentially, to speak to them. Because they're not only performing sacrifice, but they're also hearing. In fact, that's really the most important part. They're hearing. And not only will they hear the Srimad Bhagavatam, but they'll hear all the other Puranas as well. Now, Suta Goswami, he was actually given this service. He inherited it from his father, who was killed by Lord Balaram. That's a whole story that you hear later in the Bhagavatam. Because Ramaharshan Suta, his father, he was the one who was given charge of the Puranas, to protect the Puranas given by Vyasadeva. He was one of the disciples of Vyasadeva. So anyway, Suta Goswami was his son. And he was seen by the others there. These many great sages, they were assembled there at Naimisharanya Forest. That place is still there in northern India. And so they elected him to speak. So in the first chapter of this Srimad Bhagavatam, they ask him a series of questions. They're called six questions. You may have heard reference to the six questions of the sages of Naimisharanya. Actually, they're not literally in question format. They don't all have question marks at the end of them. Some of the questions are implied, and some of them are requests. They're not exactly questions. But they're asking him to speak on certain things. So I have a list of them here. I was going to go through those. Because in some ways they help to frame the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Our most prominent acharya or guru commentators, Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they've also compiled these six, and other commentators in the Bhagavatam also have made the list of these six questions. And they've also described in some ways how they're answered. But one, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur especially, he says we can understand that this is to give us some idea of what the whole Bhagavatam is about. Of course, the Bhagavatam is very, very long. 18,000 verses, 355 chapters, 12 cantos. So it covers a lot of things. But these are some of the major things that are covered. And we hear later at the end of the second canto, 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's another list, which is actually considered to be, you might say, a more fixed framework of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But here we have these questions, so I'm just going to go through these and make a few comments about them. So the first one is the ninth verse of the first chapter. These are all in the first chapter. In fact, the chapter is called Questions by the Sages. So the first thing they say is, please therefore, being blessed with many years, explain to us in an easily understandable way what you have ascertained to be the absolute and ultimate good for the people in general. So again, this idea is that they're not concerned about themselves, they're concerned about others. We know that you're a great realized soul. They say you've been blessed because of your good qualities and your submissive attitude and following the instructions and hearing attentively from your own spiritual masters. And you're very qualified to answer the questions that we're going to ask. So we want to know, how can people be benefited? As I mentioned before, in reason, they understand that people suffer because they're in ignorance. So what do people need to know? What do they need to understand? What do they need to learn to get their suffering to stop? What can we tell them? What do they need to understand? So, or what do they need to do? Another way to put it. If you're completely in ignorance, then you're going to make a lot of mistakes. And as a result of that, you're going to have to suffer. Actually, ultimately, all suffering comes from ignorance. Ignorance either because you're not informed, or ignorance in the other sense, as Prabhupada would sometimes pronounce it, ignorance, because we ignore the good advice, and we suffer even though we know better. So they want to know, what do people need to do so they won't have to suffer? So the answer to that comes in the second chapter, at least one. Again, these questions are answered throughout the Bhagavatam. But the immediate answer that Sutta Goswami is giving to some of these questions come up quite early. So in the second chapter, this verse, Savai pum sam paro dharmo yato bhakti rathoksaje ahoitukiya pratiyata yayatna suprasidati. The supreme occupation of dharma for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So there's simply no question that the dharma that's promoted in Srimad Bhagavatam is bhakti, devotional service to the Lord. It comes up, it's the main theme. It's what we're meant to aspire for above everything else. Ultimately, we're meant to aspire for service, for the service of Krishna. In fact, that's what we're chanting every day. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. We're calling out to Krishna, please engage me in your service. So that is the supreme occupation for humanity. If the only way for people to be happy is by devotional service, that's what it gets down to. Sometimes all the things that you can do in life, they're categorized they're put into four categories in the Bhagavatam. You can do karmic activity, you can do jnana, you can do yoga, or you can do bhakti. That's it, basically. Karma means what everybody is doing, pretty much. 99.9999% of people, they're doing karma, or what we say, vikarma. Vikarma means a special kind of karma, which means bad karma. Just engaging in selfish activities, trying to satisfy this body, this false sense of self that we have, trying to be happy by satisfying our body and mind and so on. That's what people are trying to do. So that's karma. Those who are a little bit more intelligent, especially if they're guided by the Vedic literature or by a bona fide spiritual master, they'll understand that, no, I'm beyond this body, I'm the soul. I have to get to the plane of spirit if I'm going to be happy. And yogis also, they understand that, especially they understand the principle that by karma, you suffer karmic reactions. So that has to stop. You have to stop your actions. So some that they have an immature understanding of what that means, and they think, well, that means we have to just stop everything, including breathing. Just exist, not do anything, and then our karma will stop, and then we won't suffer anymore. And of course, they get great powers by doing that, and they control material nature and so on. So these are different things that you can do. So you could say these are different dharmas or activities or occupations, is properly translated, that one can do, how one can use one's time in life. So the Bhagavatam promotes prema pumarto maham. The highest thing is to engage in the devotional service of Krishna. Devotional service, which means, of course, devotion with prema, with love for Krishna, to awaken your love for Krishna and to serve Him. So that's the answer to the Shonaka Rishi. He's the lead speaker of the sages of Naimisharanya. So he's asking, what can people do for their benefit? Shreya Uttamam. What is the most auspicious thing they can do for their welfare? And that's devotional service. So the next question, they say, this is in text 11, there are many varieties of scriptures, and in all of them there are many prescribed duties. You can see this aligns a little bit with the previous one, which can be learned only after many years of study in their various divisions. Therefore, O sage, please select the essence of all these scriptures and explain it for the good of all living beings, so that by such instruction their hearts may be fully satisfied. So this is, of course, a similar question again. And this has this added idea, their hearts may be satisfied, people's hearts may be satisfied. So there's the idea here is that they already know that there are so many scriptures that are meant for guiding human civilization. But there's so many of them, and they're so varied, and they seem to propose different things, or prescribe different things in different places, so it can be quite bewildering, actually. In fact, most people are bewildered. Unless you have a bona fide Vaishnava spiritual master, you're probably going to be bewildered, especially if you try to take it on by yourself and just start studying the Vedas. Think you're going to figure something out. You won't come to any conclusion. You'll think there are competing ideas. You won't think that there's a unified presentation there. But there is, actually. It's all meant for one thing, ultimately. Hari sarvatra giyate, in one shloka it says. All the different aspects of the Vedic literature, ultimately they're meant for glorification of Hari, for glorification of Krishna. So they're asking to help people because they're not very smart these days, and it's going to be very difficult for them to try to figure out all these ins and outs of the Vedic literature. So help them to focus their attention on some particular aspect of the Vedic scriptures. So interestingly, what the acharyas say is the answer to this question. You may think, well, this doesn't sound like the answer. But this is what they point out. This is 127. By rendering devotional service unto the personality of God, who is Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. So what's implied here is some of the things that the Vedas prescribe, especially these other categories, are knowledge and detachment. In fact, people may have, by studying whatever they have of the Vedic literature, they may understand, just like I said about the yogis, they think, well, we have to stop our actions. So this is detachment. We have to become detached so we don't suffer anymore. And we have to get knowledge, as I was saying also. We need knowledge so we can understand the right things to do. So this says, well, you just study the scriptures that promote devotional service and you'll get these other things automatically. There are many places, it's funny how I read quite a bit. So one thing I notice is sometimes I'll come across some idea then I'll see it. Gee, I seem to keep seeing the same idea everywhere, all over the place, which I didn't even notice it before. So one thing I've been coming across a lot is this idea that you can't have success. If you want to take one of these other paths, like jnana or yoga, you will not get success without bhakti. There has to be bhakti there. Bhakti is the power. It makes the other paths successful. You just can't get, even the jnanis, even to merge into Brahman, you cannot do that unless there's some bhakti in your practice. That has to be there. So that's the idea here is also, just go to bhakti then. Don't worry about these other things. You need, bhakti doesn't need help. That's the other point this verse brings out. You don't have to, like here it says, knowledge and detachment, you have to have those things, or they come. But they come automatically with the practice of bhakti. By sadhana bhakti, naturally, there's some detachment that's there, you follow certain rules and regulations, and understanding who we are, what the purpose of a life is, certain detachment develops, and knowledge, of course, there are different levels of knowledge. But the highest knowledge is knowledge of Krishna. Who Krishna is, what he does, his pastimes, all the intricacies of his personality. It's so amazing, actually, the knowledge that we have about God, God's psychology. We understand where it's revealed to us, how God thinks. What an amazing thing. We learn in so many ways, very subtle aspects of the Supreme Transcendence. So that's the kind of knowledge that one gets by the cultivation of bhakti. So one doesn't have to go elsewhere to try to cultivate knowledge independently. So the next question is, all blessings upon you. This is, let's see, text 12, first chapter. All blessings upon you, O Suta Goswami. You know for what purpose the personality of God had appeared in the womb of Devaki as the son of Vasudeva. Now I've heard sometimes devotees that interpret this and they think that it's about why Krishna appeared specifically from Devaki and Vasudeva. But that's not the point of the question, though. That's kind of the incidental part, who his parents were. The question is about why did he come, not who his parents are. So anyway, that's the way it's stated here. You know for what purpose the personality of God had appeared in the womb of Devaki as the son of Vasudeva. So the question, the answer is here. This is a second chapter, first canto, text 34. This is the last verse of that chapter. It says, thus the Lord of the universes maintains all planets inhabited by demigods, men, and lower animals. Assuming the roles of incarnations, he performs pastimes to reclaim those in a mode of pure goodness. So this is, actually there are many reasons why Krishna descends. In fact, Kunti Devi in her prayers in the 8th chapter of the first canto, she lists a whole list of different reasons. Says some people say you came for this reason, some people say you came for that reason. So actually Krishna comes for many reasons. Even we do things, we don't necessarily have one purpose in mind. We might want to accomplish several things. So Krishna accomplishes several things simultaneously. So here especially, it refers to his incarnations, and it also refers to Krishna's activities in creating this material world, or his expansions. But especially, of course, he's asking specifically about Krishna here. Now we know this is answered also in the 10th canto, besides this verse that I just read at the end of the second chapter. The whole 10th canto explains why Krishna came. He came to do all these things that we read about in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. As I said, the Bhagavatam is 355 chapters. Well, 90 of those chapters is just about Krishna specifically in the 10th canto. And there's quite a bit about Krishna in the first canto, at least at the end of the first canto, beginning with the 7th chapter up to 7th through like 14th chapter. There's a lot about Krishna, historical, after the Battle of Kurukshetra, what Krishna did. And then we also hear about Krishna in the beginning of the third canto, where Uddhava and Vidura are speaking. So Uddhava summarizes Krishna's pastimes there. And then, of course, again, the 10th canto. So this question is answered. They want to hear specifically about Krishna. In fact, this comes up throughout the Bhagavatam. Even though we have these specific places where Krishna is spoken about to some extent, his name comes up all over, all through all the cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The speakers and the hearers of the Bhagavatam, they keep mentioning Krishna specifically. Krishna's name comes up repeatedly. So the next one here, the fourth one. His transcendental acts are magnificent and gracious, and great learned sages like Narada sing of them. Please, therefore, speak to us who are eager to hear about the adventures he performs in his various incarnations. So here again, it's not a question, it's a request. Speak to us more about Krishna. So Vishwanath Chakravarti says that this is specifically about his incarnations. In fact, the word avatars is there in the verse. And Jiva Goswami says that actually this question is about, he's asking about the creation, or they're asking about the creation. Specifically about the creation. The one thing you find in the Bhagavatam, there's a lot about creation. It's described at least five different places. The speaker starts talking. He's asked a question by someone, and the disciple, some general questions, or maybe a whole list of questions about the absolute truth. And they start often just talking about the creation. It comes up in many different places. And you find also that the descriptions are not always the same. Because Krishna, or Krishna's empowered representative, Lord Brahma, doesn't necessarily have to do everything the same way every single day. There's lots of creations that take place. So that's described there. So that's definitely answered in the Bhagavatam. So, let's see. The 1230, this is one of the places where Jiva Goswami says this is answered about. It says, in the beginning of the material creation, the absolute personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, in his transcendental position, created the energies of cause and effect by his own internal energy. So this is just one example of the speaker entering into the topic of creation. And of course, it gets quite detailed and technical. So another question, number five. O wise Sutta, please narrate to us the transcendental pastime of the Supreme Godhead's multi-incarnations. So again, this is obviously about avatars. Such auspicious adventures and pastimes of the Lord, the Supreme Controller, are performed by his internal powers. So this is an extremely important topic, the topic of the avatars. And you find Sutta Goswami, he answers right away, actually. In the third chapter, the first canto, goes through a list of 25 or so incarnations of the Lord. So he answers that question right away. But just a quick summary, he just gives one verse on all these different avatars. And in the second canto, Lord Brahma, when he's speaking to Narada Muni, there's a chapter scheduled incarnations with specific functions. Take chapter 7 of the second canto. So there again, we get a whole list of incarnations with just some summary. Now, of course, in that third chapter, we get one of the most important verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Ete chang sakala pungsa krishnas tu bhagavan swayam. That Krishna is in a different category. He's the source of all the avatars. There's a whole list of avatars given, and it says, but Krishna is the original. Krishnas tu bhagavan swayam. Jiva Goswami, in his explaining our philosophy in his Sandarbhas, he puts a lot of weight on this. It's called the Paribhasha Sutra. It means it's the verse around which all other verses of the Bhagavatam circle. You get the understanding. If you want to understand anything in the Bhagavatam, ultimately this is the key to understanding. Because the Bhagavatam is, again, it's quite intricate. It covers a lot of different topics. Sometimes there may be things that are stated that seem to contradict this statement. But Jiva Goswami argues against that also in his Sandarbhas, especially in the Krishna Sandarbha, very emphatically hammering down. In Sanskrit, jnana especially, they talk about these different nyayas, or the philosophy of this or that. So there's something called the philosophy of hammering in the post. So when you, when you really want something to stick, you really want people to understand, then you say it over and over again. So that's why sometimes different arguments are made Jiva Goswami does this in his Sandarbhas. Sometimes you think, well, gee, okay, I get the point. But he gives another argument, and another argument, and another argument. So this is called hammering in the post. Make sure it's solid, you really understand it. So this Jiva Goswami, he does this by to establish that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all the avatars come from him. So finally, the sixth question. Since Sri Krishna, the Absolute Truth, the master of all mystic powers, has departed for his own abode, please tell us to whom the religious principles have now gone for shelter. So, of course, this is at the end of the first chapter. This is a very important question. Krishna was here. We were safe. He was guiding us. He spoke the Bhagavad Gita. And he instructed so many others also at different times and during his presence here. And of course, he's the source of all dharma. He's the source of all religious principles. So now that he's gone, where do we look for guidance? So the answer is given in this very important verse. This Bhagavat Purana is as brilliant as the sun, and it has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode, accompanied by religion, knowledge, etc. Persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. So that's Krishna, that's the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the guidance. Krishna's gone, but he's not gone. He's present in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He doesn't have to be here visible before our eyes in, quote, physical form, but he's present in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, he's present in different ways also. In the Chaitanya Bhagavat, it also says, for example, that he's present in the Ganga, because the Ganga is the water emanating from his lotus feet. So the water from his feet is as good as his feet, which is as good as all of him. So it also says he's present in the form of Tulsi Devi. Now Tulsi Devi, of course, she's not Krishna. She's one of the closest associates of Krishna. But she's from the spiritual world. We're seeing transcendence when we see Tulsi Devi. That's why it's so auspicious to see or touch or smell or taste or worship or circumambulate Srimati Tulsi Devi. So Krishna hasn't left us here high and dry. He's left us, of course, and of course he's left us his holy name. He's present in his holy name. But the Bhagavatam, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he pointed out that this is where we turn for shelter, Srimad Bhagavatam. And Lord Chaitanya took great care in instructing his associates in Srimad Bhagavatam, proper understanding of it, and encouraging people to study Srimad Bhagavatam. And that's what he did himself. You know, Lord Chaitanya, of course, he came to experience what it's like to be a devotee of himself, especially, of course, a particular devotee, Srimati Radharani, but in general, what it's like to be a bhakta. So what was his sadhana? Chanting Hare Krishna and reading Srimad Bhagavatam, especially. And he read Srimad Bhagavatam, especially in Puri, of course with Ramananda Rai and Srupa Damodara, but especially with Gadadhar Pandit. Now, you may know, this is very esoteric, but Gadadhar Pandit is Srimati Radharani. Without her, Man means her getting angry and harsh and chastising, arguing with Krishna and so on. She's the soft Radha. But without her Pandit, in some ways he's extremely important in Lord Chaitanya's advent, because Lord Chaitanya came to experience what it's like to be Radha, so Radha came along to help him. So how did he help? He helped by reading Srimad Bhagavatam together with him. That's how you learn to love Krishna like Srimati Radharani does, by studying Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course, it's a very long book. It takes a lot of effort to read it, but it should be Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. We're meant to read it. Prabhupada instituted reading Srimad Bhagavatam daily. All the things that Prabhupada did, of course, they had a purpose to them. He didn't have to do that. He could have made other arrangements to do different things, but he encouraged us not only to study in Srimad Bhagavatam class, but whenever we had time, he encouraged us to read his books, especially Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So all of these, they all work together, actually, to form us, to form our devotional character. The Bhagavad Gita, especially, it helps to grab our intelligence. And of course, it brings us to the point of surrender. Actually, spiritual life begins with surrender. Sometimes we think, well, I'm working my way to surrender. But actually, spiritual life begins with surrender. That's where it starts. In fact, when you accept a spiritual master, you're supposed to be surrendered completely to your spiritual master. Right? So that's when your spiritual life begins. And then when that attitude is there, then you can say you start getting it. You start connecting. It starts resonating within you. It starts vibrating within you, a transcendental vibration. And you become changed. You become transformed. Your heart becomes transformed. So these things work together. We're meant to read Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So today I thought I would give a little emphasis to Srimad Bhagavatam. So I'll stop here. Anyone has any questions? Yes, put you in the back. The green light is on, then it's on.
Oh, thank you for your class. I wanted to ask, because you just mentioned, you know, once you have the spiritual master and other things, you become transformed. So my question is, what happens if you never get initiated by a spiritual master in your life? I was just curious. Thank you.
Yeah, you should avoid that. Actually, it said it's imperative. You have to have a spiritual master. Now, you can prepare. Yeah, you should prepare yourself. But really, the spiritual master plants the seed. We have this metaphor there in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The spiritual master plants the seed. Then you water the seed by following his instructions. In fact, Prabhupada even says that the instructions are the seed of the spiritual master. But still, there's that formal acceptance of the spiritual master that has to be done. And then you really take off. That's when your spiritual life really begins, when you accept the spiritual master. Because humility, for one thing, there are many reasons, but this is an important one. There has to be some humility. You can't think that I can do it on my own. And Krishna says you can't do it on your own, so that's pretty good evidence right there. He says you must do it. He sets up the rules. And he says, no, you have to go through one of my representatives. And then he will guide you. And, you know, even though, of course, we have Srila Prabhupada's books still, this is the tradition from time immemorial. This is the procedure that we still follow. You accept the spiritual master and you take his guidance. And, that's supposed to be the attitude. Dasavat, in the seventh canto, it says, Dasavat, just like a dasa. Dasa means a servant. I was thinking, sometimes I think of this, I think some devotees, we live in a culture where this idea of being a servant is really, you know, it's really looked down upon. But sometimes I see devotees who just their nature seems to be like that automatically. They like to serve people. And I think, see, I've kind of, I don't know why, because of my karma or whatever, but I've never, I tend not to be in that kind of subordinate role in my life, I might say. And I think, well, I'm missing out on something. It's actually a good thing to be that you have a nature where you just naturally like to serve people. Because you can dovetail that in Krishna consciousness. In fact, there's one, I think it's the end of the, I forget if it's Prithu Maharaj or Dhruva Maharaj's chapter, the pastimes. It gives different pala shruti, blessings that you get. So like if you hear this, if you're a king, then you'll be a king of many other kings. And if you're a Brahmin, then I forget what they are. But it says, if you're a Sudra, you'll get pure devotional service. Say, well, that's nice. I wish I was a Sudra instead of a Brahmin. I'd get pure devotional service. So my point is this attitude of being a servant. There are many places too where Prabhupada says, the devotee's only desire is to serve Krishna. So I think, well, I don't always think like, not always, maybe I hardly ever think that way. I'm tempted to be thinking, Well, I'm just doing these things because this is sadhana bhakti. I want to be purified and I want to make spiritual advancement. But I'm not thinking, oh, I have to serve Krishna. I want to serve Krishna. That burning desire must be there within my heart. So that's also, it's tied into the idea of humility. I want to serve my guru. You can say maybe this is the main characteristic. This was Srila Prabhupada's power, wasn't it? That's what he wanted to do. My spiritual master asked me to do this. I'm going to do this. No matter what, even if it killed me, which it almost did, right? That was what you might say made him who he was. That burning desire to fulfill the order of the spiritual master. So that's why it's so important to take that on. As Prabhupada would quote off in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur commentary in Bhagavad Gita, that the order of the spiritual master must be the life and soul of the disciple. So unless one has a spiritual master, one doesn't have life and soul yet. Life hasn't begun. I was starting with that, the analogy of the seed. So you can prepare the soil, that's nice, put nutrients in the soil and cultivate it and so on, use your rototiller and whatever. But at some point you have to put the seed in. So it has to be done. But there has to be very serious desire to come to that point of initiation. And of course, I know there are challenges, you know, we live in certain times and not used to that thing and it may be difficult. But now, of course, what Prabhupada would say is that Krishna, in fact, this is a saying that you don't find the guru finds you. Krishna sends you the guru. You pray to Krishna, Krishna will send you the guru. And then you have to be able to see, to understand that this is, Krishna sending me this person. This is a transcendental experience. I often think of Lord Brahma when you heard the words tapa. So if I heard tapa, I'd just probably scratch my head. What's that? But Brahma understood, no, this is transcendental sound. He knew somehow within his heart, I'm being given an instruction that I have to meditate. That's really that the context of that tapa is you have to engage in intense meditation, then everything will be revealed to you. So he was able to recognize this is God. In other words, this is God, this is the voice of God speaking to me. So we have to be able to recognize when the guru comes and be submissive and accept Krishna's sending this person to me. I have to accept that. All right, kind of a long-winded answer, yeah.
Thank you for answering my question.
You're welcome. Okay, over here. Another Uchida.
I was just thinking, Srimad Bhagavatam is also really relishable when read and discussed with association.
Read in association.
Yeah. Like you were saying, Gadadhar would read Gaur Chaitanya. And you see the Goswamis similar. And just right. I've just noticed how relishable mm-hmm. it is. And it brings out so many other things that maybe you'll not even notice.
Yeah.
But
yes, it's stuff like that, actually. Generally, it's good to read together with others and discuss Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada always encouraged us to do that. That's also traditional. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that devotees get together and they talk Krishna Gita together. So that's the joy of the devotees. And Krishna also says, I am present there when devotees get together to talk about me, that I am present in that association. So that's important. And it helps that when Krishna's there, it means it helps us to understand we're getting an extra help from Krishna's being present there for it to enter our hearts. Yeah, go ahead.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. A question that comes to mind is with reference to a prayer or a song that we sing often in the morning. It's like Chakri Dhamma Dhiroje Dhamma Dhamma Padusse. And the reason why that comes to mind is my understanding of the translation is like my Lord birth after birth. mm-hmm. and it's referring to Srila Prabhupada. So a point of confusion for me is like I have heard from another devotee who was like, yes, if you are to take initiation, it is not that you are like, you know, essentially stepping on that person that you take initiation from to like go to Prabhupada, just as like someone who took initiation when Prabhupada was physically present wasn't intending or endeavoring to do so in order to like go to Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master. So can you help? I don't know if my question is clear here, but I'm a little confused, I suppose.
Well, first of all, in ISKCON, we say Srila Prabhupada, you know, there are three kinds of spiritual masters, actually. Bhartma Padarshika Guru means the person who first introduces you to Krishna. And then there are instructing gurus, Siksha Gurus, and then there's the Diksha Guru. So we have one Diksha Guru, and then we may have many Siksha Gurus, instructing spiritual masters. So Srila Prabhupada, because he's the founder Acharya of ISKCON, he's the Siksha Guru for everyone in ISKCON. Naturally, we study his books, and we're taking, either we're disciples, some of us are his direct disciples, and some are disciples of his disciples, and so on. But it's his mood, his vision, his way of presenting Krishna consciousness, his bhava, he can say, his attitude that we try to emulate. So he's the one who is guiding us. But still, it's required that we have a diksha initiating spiritual master. Now, what this line means in that song, I don't know exactly what it means, to tell you the truth. For one thing, Narottam Das Thakur wrote it for his spiritual master. So whether he intended it to be an instruction for all of us exactly, I mean, when I think in a kind of logical way, I think, well, how could it possibly be that this same jiva soul is going to keep coming back? You know, Prabhupada had something like 4,400 disciples. Is he going to keep coming back for them? Can he never go back to God himself? And every time he comes back, he's going to make new disciples, so does he just stay in this material world forever? So I tend to think of it, now I'm not saying this is Shastra, but I tend to think this is more the mood of the disciple, that I'm never going to give up, this person is my guru, and he's my guru forever, and so on. So we say life after life. Now whether literally that's what it means, I'm not exactly sure. But this is in the heart of the disciple. I never want to be separated from this person. Now, of course, it's also said that when you go to the spiritual world, your spiritual master can be there, or maybe is there, as your guru, your guide when you enter Goloka Vrindavan to tell you how to be a gopi or cowherd boy or whatever. So this is, of course, very elevated topics that are difficult to understand. So that understanding may also be there. But to me, it's more about the heart of the matter. This is the way that I see my spiritual master. I'm never going to give him up. And so I see that way. I may stay in this world for many lifetimes, like Prabhupada said, my coming crores of births in this material world. So we may think we're going to be here that long. But this person will always be my guide. I will see him eternally in that way. So some of these things, you know, what is the literal meaning of them? Sometimes maybe it's a little hard to pin down exactly what it means. I know we like that. We like things to be, you know, squared off and black and white and, you know, literal and so on. But they may not necessarily work that way. The spiritual world is in another dimension, infinite dimensions. We live in three dimensions. The spiritual world has infinite dimensions. So there may be many, many things that are beyond our conception. But the heart of the matter is what's important. That we take on an attitude like that, even though if you start thinking of it logically, maybe you'll say, wait a minute, how can that be? Which I tend to do. The intellect gets in the way sometimes. The heart is more important. You have to just use your heart. Prabhu, you had something? I don't know, you can all leave whenever you want if you're hungry.
Thank you for a very nice class. My question is, a lot of research has been done on the language and the grammar and the words which were used in Vedas and Puranas and Mahabharata. And the words and the grammar which was used in Vedas and verses in Puranas that indicate that it has been written, you know, several thousands of years apart, and because the language and the grammar. How can we?
Now that is why. So the question is, why are there different grammars, language? The language that there is classical Sanskrit and, you know, Vedic Sanskrit, for example, and they're not exactly the same. Now, one way I heard Gopi Puranadan Prabhu, who was an ISKCON Sanskritist, translator and commentator, very well read in the Vedic literature. One of his explanations was that actually because they're speaking to different audiences, and it's not necessarily that this means that historically there's a reason for it. Now, there may be, but it's also because, for example, the Puranas are spoken more for the common man. And they don't require the kind of expertise in Sanskrit that the traditional Vedas do. If you're performing a Vedic sacrifice, you have to get not only the pronunciation of each letter, each vowel correct, but you have to do it in the right tune, even the right tone, the pitch. You have to get the pitch right. Not only the pronunciation, but you have to get the pitch right. And if you make a mistake, there can be dire consequences. So they're spoken for a particular class of people, really. That's one reason why, you know, traditionally Shudras weren't allowed to recite the Vedas, because they could make a mistake and cause a lot of havoc. So this is one reason. One way to look at it is that just like now, all over the world, people speak differently. Just like English, you know, Indian English and people in Spain, when they speak English, it doesn't quite sound like people. Even in America, people in the South speak different than people in New York. We all speak a little bit different with pronunciation, but we're speaking the same language. So it's not necessarily because, you know, that there's a historical reason for that, but there's some other reason. So there may be some other reason than, you know, the original, what we call the original four Vedas. Somehow, there's this idea, this elitist idea, that I will just study the Vedas because those are the original, the Rig Veda. I'll study the Rig Veda. You know. Now, these Puranas, these are for simple-minded people and so on. Look at the language, it's so simple. But actually, the point being made in the Puranas are the highest. They're the highest, especially the Bhagavatam. You know, Vyasadeva, if he wrote the 18 Puranas, then he wrote the Mahabharata. And then, after he spoke with Narada Muni, because he wasn't satisfied after all that, then Narada Muni spoke to him and said, you haven't glorified Krishna enough directly. So then he revised the original, because there was already a Bhagavat Purana. There were 18 Puranas. But he revised that one and made it better, made it more Krishna conscious, you can say. So it contains the Vyasadeva, who, he knew everything. He knew all the Vedas. Even today, people in India, they have names. Their family traditional name may be Trivedi or Chaturvedi. It means they were from Brahmin lines, and they knew, at least in the past, you know, they knew all four Vedas or three Vedas or two Vedas, Dvivedi. So Vyasadeva, obviously, he knew everything, but he still wasn't satisfied until he wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam after Narada was telling him. In fact, Vyasadeva, if you read in the Bhagavatam, he was kind of sensing in himself. Maybe my Bhagavatam wasn't Krishna conscious enough. So Narada came and told him, yes, get more specific about the Krishna. So even though the language is simpler, the message is not simpler. And the message is the highest thing. So we shouldn't get too disturbed by the, you know, the differences in the language in the Vedic literature. There may be different reasons for it. The other thing is, these things are eternal. That's another thing that's hard for us to grasp, especially the Bhagavatam, because it seems like a historical document. It seems to be take place at a certain time in history. But actually, these shastras are eternal. They exist eternally. And they come out just like there are different avatars. So the Bhagavatam is also an avatar. So avatars come at different times throughout history. So Krishna can reveal himself through the Bhagavatam whenever he wants to. So if you, another way to look at it is, yes, the Vedic language changed and Krishna revealed himself through the language of that was prominent at that time for people to understand, for more common people to understand. That was his great blessing for people. So Krishna can accomplish many things, and it's not that the things are always revealed necessarily. Sometimes Krishna has tricks too. Just like we know Lord Buddha, he was a trickster. He came for a particular reason. He cheated, actually. He cheated people. So to get them to a certain place spiritually. So Krishna may not necessarily reveal exactly what his tactics are and what he's doing. But we can be assured that we're getting the highest message in the Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, the Bhagavatam, you know, it's said that I forget how it goes, but different aspects of the Vedas, some teach like a father or a strict authoritarian, and some teach like a mother, and some teach like a lover. So the Bhagavatam teaches like all three. It actually has, and it also has classical Sanskrit in it and Vedic Sanskrit in it. So it's quite it's a very unusual book, actually, even from, you might say, an academic perspective. The Bhagavatam is quite unique. And a very powerful, of course, very powerful to transform us. Okay, I don't want to go on too long. Let's stop here. Hare Krishna.